Good evening. 1 Samuel chapter 20. I shall read the whole chapter. 1 Samuel chapter 20 and verse 1. Then David fled from Naoth in Ramah and went and said to Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my iniquity? What is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?" So Jonathan said to him, "By no means, you shall not die. Indeed, my father will do nothing, either great or small, without first telling me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so." Then David took an oath again and said, "Your father certainly knows that I have found favor in your eyes. And he has said, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved.' But truly, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death." So Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you yourself desire, I will do it for you." And David said to Jonathan, "Indeed, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit with the king to eat. But let me go, that I may hide in the field until the third day at evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, 'David earnestly asked permission of me that he might run over to Bethlehem, his city. There is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family.' If he says thus, 'It is well,' your servant will be safe. But if he is very angry, be sure that evil is determined by him. Therefore you shall deal kindly with your servant. You have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. Nevertheless, if there is iniquity in me, kill me yourself. Why should you bring me to your father?" But Jonathan said, "Far be it from you. For if I knew certainly that evil was determined by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you?" Then David said to Jonathan, "Who will tell me? Or what if your father answers you roughly?" And Jonathan said to David, "Come, let us go out into the field." So both of them went out into the field. Then Jonathan said to David, "The Lord God of Israel is witness. When I have sounded out my father sometime tomorrow or the third day, and indeed there is good toward David, and I do not send to you and tell you, may the Lord do so and much more to Jonathan. But if it pleases my father to do you evil, then I will report it to you and send you away, and you may go in safety. And the Lord be with you, as he has been with my father. And you shall not only show me the kindness of the Lord while I still live, that I may not die, but you shall not cut off your kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Lord has cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "Let the Lord require it at the hand of David's enemies." Now Jonathan again caused David to vow because he loved him. For he loved him as he loved his own soul. Then Jonathan said to David, "Tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed, because your seat will be empty. And when you have stayed 3 days, go down quickly and come to the place where you hid on the day of the deed, and remain by the stone Ezel. Then I will shoot 3 arrows to the side, as though I shot at a target. And there I will send a lad, saying, 'Go and find the arrows.' If I expressly say to the lad, 'Look, the arrows are on this side of you, get them and come,' then, as the Lord lives, there is safety for you and no harm. But if I say thus to the young man, 'Look, the arrows are beyond you, go your way, for the Lord has sent you away.' And as for the matter which you and I have spoken of, indeed, the Lord between you and me forever." Then David hid in the field. And when the new moon had come, the king sat down to eat the feast. Now the king sat on his seat, as at other times, on a seat by the wall. And Jonathan arose, and Abner, sat by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, something has happened to him. He is unclean. Surely he is unclean. And it happened the next day, the second day of the month, that David's place was empty. And Saul said to Jonathan, his son, why has the son of Jesse not come to eat, either yesterday or today? So Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked permission of me to go to Bethlehem. And he said, please, let me go, for our family has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. And now, if I have found favor in your eyes, please let me get away and see my brothers. Therefore he has not come to the king's table. Then Saul's anger was aroused against Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, you shall not be established, nor your kingdom. Now therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. And Jonathan answered Saul his father and said to him, why should he be killed? What has he done? Then Saul cast a spear at him to kill him, by which Jonathan knew that it was determined by his father to kill David. So Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David, because his father had treated him shamefully. And so it was in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field at the time appointed with David, and a little lad was with him. Then he said to his lad, now run, find the arrows which I shoot. As the lad ran, he shot an arrow behind him. When the lad had come to the place where the arrow was which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan cried out after the lad and said, is not the arrow beyond you? And Jonathan cried out after the lad, make haste, hurry, do not delay. So Jonathan's lad gathered up the arrows and came back to his master. But the lad did not know anything. Only Jonathan and David knew of the matter. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to his lad and said to him, go, carry them to the city. As soon as the lad had gone, David arose from a place toward the south, fell on his face to the ground, and bowed down three times. And they kissed one another, and they wept together, but David more so. Then Jonathan said to David, go in peace, since we have both sworn in the name of the Lord, saying, may the Lord be between you and me, and between your descendants and my descendants forever. So he arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. That was a long reading. I find it one of the most moving chapters in the whole of Scripture. What I'd like to do this evening, and you'll be familiar with my usual manner of preaching, which is going through verse by verse. There are rather a lot of those verses. I'm going to look at all four characters in the chapter, and I'm just going to make perhaps 3 points about each one. The good thing about looking at the life of one of the people in the Bible is that you get to study character rather than just events. And the context, of course, is chapter 19, Saul. He's desperately trying to kill David, and he sends various messengers of death to him, but they come under the power of God and their plans are thwarted. And then Saul arrives and he too comes under the power and the influence of God. Nevertheless, we're told in verse 1 that David flees from Naoth. Saul may be humiliated, laying naked on the ground, prophesying. But David knows that Saul is a man who is eaten up with evil, and that when he gets up, that murderous intention is still likely to be there. And so David flees. And David, although he is popular, he possibly feels like he has very few friends. He went to Samuel, but even the care of Samuel doesn't seem to keep him from Saul, because Saul has spies even in Samuel's area. And so, of course, he has a conversation with Jonathan. And there is perhaps an element of doubt in David. Will Jonathan keep to his word? Saul doesn't keep to his word. And I know I've said it previously, but it's always worth remembering that Jonathan had the most to lose because of David. Jonathan could lose the kingdom, his position, because of David. So, let's look very briefly at King Saul. The first point I'd like to make is that Saul assumes the worst of people. There is evidently a feast for the new moon, and all the officials and the important people gather together. They each have their places. There is Abner, there is Saul. Saul is expecting David to come along. Perhaps he considers it another opportunity to kill him. Why not? And David doesn't turn up. And Saul wonders to himself where David might be. In verse 25, Abner sat by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, something has happened to him. He is unclean. Surely he is unclean. And of course, the reference there is if he's ceremonially unclean, he's not able to partake of the feast. But it's interesting that Saul does not think that David hasn't attended, because David would rather like to be alive. And Saul would rather like him to be dead. And therefore, it's quite natural that David does not turn up. But Saul's explanation that he comes up with in his head is that David has somehow polluted himself. He has not managed to make himself ceremonially clean to attend it. Saul is assuming the worst of David. Oh, he must have committed some sin, or he's done something inappropriate to render him unfit to be here. Ignoring his own malice and his own hatred. When he thinks of David, he simply assumes he has done something wrong. One of the problems when sin governs a human heart is that we judge other people by our own horrible standards. Have you noticed how perhaps in times you've behaved quite rightly, but somebody else has interpreted your actions as being evil? And you know full well that that wasn't the case. Why would they think such of you? It's because, almost certainly, they're applying their own rotten standards to you. There was somebody unclean, but it wasn't David, it was Saul. Notice in verse 27, which reads, David's place was empty, and Saul said to Jonathan his son, "Why has the son of Jesse not come to eat, either yesterday or today?" Saul can't even speak David's name. The son of Jesse. Now we know that Jesse wasn't quite a nobody, but neither do I think he was of noble lineage. He certainly wasn't of royal lineage. So to refer to him as the son of Jesse is perhaps almost a hint of snobbery. Whatever you think of Margaret Thatcher, let me say that one of the battles she had to fight in her life in the Tory party was being known as the grocer's daughter. She's a nobody. She ought to be minding a shop like her father. And you can imagine some of the posh landowners in the Conservative Party looking down at this woman. But there is a hatred in Saul that cannot even allow him to say the name of David, or to describe him in terms perhaps at which Abner would start smirking, because, yeah, he's a nobody. The nobody is the son of a nobody, and neither is he here. Have you noticed the animosity in this world to the name of Jesus Christ? You see, the sinful heart in a state of enmity to God cannot even bear the name of our beautiful Messiah. It's okay to blaspheme it, but the name itself is regarded in the same way as he was. Despised and afflicted, a man acquainted with grief. The third point I'd like to make about Saul is that his hatred and murderous intent is transferable. Saul so far has been trying to kill David. Two or three times he's attempted to throw a spear or a javelin at him. In verse 30, we get this really, really quite horrible speech aimed at Jonathan. You son of a perverse, rebellious woman. He's talking about his wife there. Do I not know you've chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? No, let me tell you, this covenant between Jonathan and David was to the glory of God, not to Jonathan's mother's shame. And in verse 33, then Saul cast a spear at him to kill him. Previously, he's trying to kill his son-in-law. Now he's trying to kill his son. You see, once you consider one life cheap and worthy of murder, it's very easy, I imagine, to apply that same principle to any other. You look at what happened in Nazi Germany. And they start by killing off disabled people. And once you establish the principle that these people's lives are not worth living, it's very, very easy then to construct gas chambers and kill all sorts of people because life is cheap. Sin is very dexterous. It's able to adapt and apply to any new given situation. Look at Adam and Eve. It begins with one little act of rebellion and how that has multiplied and magnified over the years. Let's look at Jonathan. Jonathan is wonderfully trusting. Now, in verse 1, David comes to him and says, "What have I done? Why is your father trying to kill me?" And Jonathan doesn't believe him. I don't think Jonathan is aware of what has happened in the previous chapter. At least in the second part. We know that Jonathan persuades Saul to spare David's life, and Saul makes an oath to confirm that David will live. And Jonathan assumes that his father is a man of his word. If he said he won't kill you, David, he won't kill you. What are you worried about? You shall not die. Indeed, my father will do nothing, great or small, without first telling me. Why should my father hide this thing from me? He says in verse 2. Is he naive? Possibly. And yet it's a naivety born out of love for his father. And whereas I said before that Saul judges other people by his own sinful standards, I cannot help but wonder that Jonathan projects onto other people his high standards. If Jonathan says he will do something, he will do it. If he says he won't do something, he won't do it. He imagines his father has the same level of dignity and integrity, and he has not. There's many a Christian who's been taken advantage of over the years. And yet better to be taken advantage of than to be the one taking advantage. Jonathan expresses real spiritual insight. In verse 13, when he's more persuaded that Saul's intentions are murderous, he says, "But if it pleases my father to do you evil, then I will report it to you and send you away, that you may go in safety, and the Lord be with you, as he has been with my father." Jonathan acknowledges here that David's safety does not even depend upon Jonathan's loyalty, nor the failure of his father to concoct his plans, but for the Lord being with him. He even acknowledges that his father has had the Lord being with him as well. Jonathan can see that despite the wickedness of Saul, the Lord has been with him. I previously wondered why the Lord, by the way, will allow that spirit to vex Saul. In having studied it further, I cannot help but wonder, it was perhaps even an act of mercy on God's part, that he might cry out to God once more and ask him for help. And Jonathan is aware that the Lord has been with his father, could be with his father again. Jonathan also has an eye on the future. In verses 15 and 16, there's a sense by which Jonathan knows he's going to die, perhaps sooner rather than later. "But you shall not cut off your kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Lord has cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "Let the Lord require it at the hand of David's enemies." Jonathan knows that David's star is on the rise, as it were. And he says, "Even when I'm dead, have a care for my children." Some of you will know the story of Mephibosheth. Jonathan anticipated the day when David would be king, and his enemies defeated, and Saul will be no more, and Jonathan will be no more. And Jonathan says to David, "Don't kill my children. When I'm not there and you can no longer show love to me, show love to them who are mine." And David does. Let's look at 3 points about David. The first and most obvious one is that he's innocent. Kings and magistrates are appointed by God. They are his sword. Human government is the means by which God, in our fallen world, limits and restrains the wicked human heart. It is imperfect. We long for the reign of Christ when he comes again. But in the meantime, civil government has that purpose. And Saul is entitled to punish and restrain. But not the innocent. "What have I done? What is my iniquity? What is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?" David knows that he is innocent. Jonathan knows that he is innocent. Saul, in the previous chapter, is persuaded, but his hatred and his malice stops him from seeing it. Peter is writing to churches in his epistles, and he comes to those group of people, the slaves in households, and he says, don't behave in such a way that you get the beating because of your poor conduct. If you're going to get such a thing, let it be for Christ. Even in the daily work that you have to do, may it all be above board. Be innocent in the eyes of this world. He has wisdom. In verse 3, David took an oath again and said, your father certainly knows that I have found favor in your eyes, and he has said, do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death. We know that Jonathan is perhaps a little naive, a little trusting. He has perhaps a higher view of his father than his father deserves. But David has got the measure of the king. And he knows full well that he is still planning to kill David, but to keep Jonathan out of the equation, because Jonathan, of course, would save David. And he's able to see into that situation and understand what's going on. David is indeed as innocent as a dove, and yet he's aware of the cunning of serpents. He's innocent. He is wise. But he's also trusting of Jonathan and his covenant. If you're familiar with the ways of the world, if you're familiar with the ways of the people of the world, but you have the love of Christ in your heart, don't become untrusting and hard. If people have taken advantage of you, don't assume that no one can be trusted. David might quite reasonably might say, well, I'm having nothing to do with Jonathan. I can't trust Saul. I can't trust him. What he says, therefore, in verse 8, you shall deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. David quite rightly does not trust the king. But that doesn't mean he can't trust the prince. I know people who have had difficult times in churches, and as a result, they can never really get over that. Then, of course, there's a fourth character. I don't know his name. The lad. Jonathan's lad. As far as I'm aware, he never comes back into the Bible. He has a brief cameo role, and yet I like him. He's tasked with menial work. In verse 36, Jonathan says, now run, find the arrows which I shoot. This young man has been given a job at the palace. Perhaps he comes from a poor background. Perhaps he comes from a well-to-do background, and the idea of getting quite close to royalty with all its preferment and avenues for promotion. Maybe he has ambitious parents, I don't know. But look at the job he's given. It's a job you might give to a dog. You throw a stick and the dog brings it back. Okay, you might not want to trust a dog with an arrow, but it's a similar principle. I'm going to shoot some arrows into a field and you're going to keep bringing them back to me. Well, if he comes from quite a well-to-do background, he's probably not too keen on this. This wasn't quite what he signed up for. He thought he might be doing something rather more elevated. The second thing about him is that he's given rather strange instructions. But he still obeys. Verse 37. When the lad had come to the place where the arrow was, which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan cried out after the lad and said, "Is not the arrow behind you?" Let's just look at it from this lad's point of view. He's been given a very, very simple task. Too simple. The prince has shot an arrow and there it is in the ground. So off he goes to get it. It says he goes to the place where the arrow was. It's quite simple. There's the arrow. Pick up the arrow. Take the arrow back. What can go wrong? Then Jonathan says, "Is not the arrow behind you? Beyond you?" Well, no, actually. It's right here in front of me. What's he talking about? And Jonathan cried out after the lad, "Make haste, hurry, do not delay." Jonathan, it's only an arrow. You have plenty more. Now we know he wasn't talking to the lad, he was talking to David. And of course this lad doesn't know that. At this point he could have become quite cross. Or offended. Telling me to hurry up and not delay. Who does he think he is? We have no record of what was going on inside his head. And yet look in verse 40. And Jonathan gave his weapons to the lad and said, "Go carry them into the city." That's more dignified. To be given the weapons of the prince to carry. Remember, as a token of honour, Jonathan previously has given his sword to David. "This is my strength, this is my dignity, I offer it to you." Okay, he's not quite offering them to the lad, but he's entrusting his very, very valuable weapons to this young man. This lad was used by God, and he did not even know it. He thought it was just menial work. He thought he was being patronized by his employer. But let me tell you, this lad was God's instrument by which the royal house of David, from which Messiah would come, was being delivered from evil. And whatever you do and wherever you are, that boring job, that little work, that little contribution you make in that little church in the middle of nowhere, it might have eternal consequences. It might be that that lad never knew anymore. He one day grew up, told his children and his grandchildren about once he gathered some arrows and that was it. It was very strange, can't account for it. And yet we know, and God knows, that what little he did that day had eternal consequences. And the other point I'd make is that that lad was faithful with that menial work, and therefore he was given more. And I believe that God looks at you and I, and that we who are faithful with a little will one day be trusted with much more. Amen.